So the title I gave to tonight's talk is Working with Reactive Emotions. By reactive emotions, I mean our mental habit of something disturbing us, something that's shaking us, and we react, as opposed to pausing and going, maybe I don't have to, whatever. These reactions always have a strong emotional component to them. So that's a very loose definition of reactive emotions, what I want to talk about tonight. And why would we bother wanting to work with them, I suppose, is a legitimate question to ask first. And that is, this is where we often get ourselves into trouble. This is where, more than any other way, through unwholesome acts of speech and mind and body, we cause trouble for ourselves and for others. So if we learn how to work with these reactive states as opposed to letting them work us, it makes for a much more pleasant life, and it's also how we one way we progress along the path. And I want to do this by talking about two different suttas where the Buddha talked about these things quite explicitly. And they're both quite famous suttas as well, so some of you might recognize these things. The first one is called the Simile of the Cloth. And I'll actually read parts of all of these suttas to you as what I'm doing here. Bhikkhus. So bhikkhu is a traditionally means a monk, but in the sense of the North American Western practice we live, that means people who practice and study. That means you. So this is addressed to you. Bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine. It would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Suppose, bhikkhus, a cloth were bright and pure, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine. It would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. So the first thing I want to point out is this is what the Buddha did all the time. He took very common, everyday things. Things that everyone would understand immediately. I mean, back in the day, if you wanted a cloth other than the color of the whatever you made, the material you used to make the cloth, you dyed it yourself. I mean, you went on, you gathered the right kinds of roots and things, and you made some dye, and you dyed the cloth. You know, you didn't go to the store and buy a package of RIT anymore like we do these days. You actually had to make the dye and dye it yourself. So everyone who was listening to this would understand immediately what the Buddha was talking about. That no, if you took a cloth that was dirty and dyed it, it wouldn't look good. So the images he used are always like this. They're very common, everyday things. And we'll see that as I go through the talk, where all of the images are like, oh yeah, I know what that means. Yeah. And so what he's saying here, obviously, is that if you're taking up this practice, we have to understand that this is a practice where purification is part of the practice. In fact, it's the beginning of the practice. In fact, here's another quote. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta. The Satipatthana Sutta is the Buddha's main instructions on meditation practice. So it's quite an important teaching. This is how the sutta begins, the very beginning of the sutta. He says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. He's not messing around. He's saying this is about purifying yourself. And then the thing, of course, is we have to be careful. because it's very easy to get caught up in the, oh, I'm so impure, I'm no good, I can't do this practice, headspace. This is unhelpful. This is also incorrect. It's not, we're not trying to beat ourselves up with this practice. We're trying to wake ourselves up with this practice. And we're trying to sort of see what our nature might be and how we can change that nature over time. The Buddha goes on in this sutta. He says, what bhikkhus are the imperfections that defile the mind? Covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence are all imperfections that defile the mind. Pretty big list, huh? What he's basically saying is, look, at these are all things that are part of human beings. There's nothing there that's like, we don't know what it means, once again. This is all things that we need to be aware of. But, going back to what I said about being careful not to beat ourselves up. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And it's actually from a chapter called Hindrances, a Dirty Cloth. I wonder where he got that idea, that name. Huh? The first thing you might remind yourself in times of difficulty, others when you're caught up in being afflicted by, these are sometimes called afflictive emotions as well. When you're afflicted in times of difficulty is the fact that you have already accumulated great powers of purity and liberation in your mind. He's reminding us that that's our nature as well. That truth may be hard to remember or to believe in the midst of some mental storm of fear, anger, intense craving, or whatever, but it is true. Otherwise, you would not be here as a human being. This precious human birth is the certain result of our own past wholesome actions. The fact that we've been drawn to the practice, the path of awakening, indicates even stronger forces of purity within us. His Holiness Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, one of the great Tibetan masters of this century, wrote, ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants on this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born as a human being. How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dharma? How many of those who start continue? Reflecting in this way on our own interest in the Dharma generates feelings of joy and confidence. So, look on the bright side. And it's true, you wouldn't be here. I mean, you'd be home watching the Rockies on TV or something, right? You wouldn't be here if you hadn't already accumulated a great deal of purity. So, we're in the process. We're in the process. We still have some way to go. We still got some work to do. Some of us less, some of us more, maybe. But we're all working at it. That's what the practice. This is the practice of purification. And so, that's what we're trying to do. Is somehow get over these things. So what does the Buddha say about how to get over them? This is an interesting line too. Knowing that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind, a bhikkhu abandons it. Period. A bhikkhu abandons it. Abandons an interesting word, huh? To use this, use here. It's what the dictionary says about the word abandon. To leave completely and finally, forsake utterly, desert, or to give up, discontinue, withdraw from. It's like abandon. Not going to go there anymore. That's the choice we have to make. The fact is, of course, is we'll make that choice and we'll fail. And we'll make the choice again and we'll fail again. It's a process. It's a practice. You know, practice implies failure. Don't ever forget. It's not like, okay, I'll make up my mind. I'm never going to be angry again. And then you're never going to be angry again. Nah, it's not going to work that way. But I can decide, I'm going to try and be less angry. I'm going to try and work on this and not get caught so often and catch it earlier. Now it's a process. Now it's a practice as opposed to, you know, something I can beat myself up with because I failed again. You're going to fail. We all fail all the time. It's just part of being a human being. But over time, as we see these things arise in the mind over and over and over again, we learn to gradually change so that they don't afflict us as much or as often. That's the practice. So now there's another sutta I want to go into a bit more detail about. This is called the simile of the saw. Once again, the Buddha used simile and metaphor a lot as ways of explaining things. He'd take common everyday things and stories, and this particular sutta has several different pieces to it that all are very familiar kind of stories that we run into all the time. The first of these is a story about this bhikkhu Paguna, who basically spends a lot of time hanging out with the bhikkhunis, the nuns. He's a monk. And not only that, if anybody attacks the bhikkhunis, says anything rude to them, he gets really angry and yells at these people. And if the bhikkhunis see him being yelled at, they defend him and get angry. So he's in the midst of, he's a troublemaker in the middle of the things a lot of the time, is what it basically says. And this is what the Buddha has to say about this. Paguna, is it true that you are associating overmuch with the bhikkhunis? That you are associating too much with the bhikkhunis? That is, that if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating so much with bhikkhunis, as it seems? Yes, Venerable Sir. Paguna, you are not a clansman. Are you not a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from the home into the life of homelessness? Yes, Venerable Sir. Paguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon, you should abandon any desire and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus: my mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. This is how you should train, Paguna. So what's the Buddha getting at here? He's getting at two things, actually. The first one is, in this particular person's case, he's a monk. He's gone forth. He's homeless. This has a whole set of rules attached to it. 235 rules or so. I forget, there's some huge number of rules of how you're supposed to lead your life. Dealing with, you know, how you eat and where you eat and how you tie your cloth and lots of things. And
this Pragunha is sort of caught up in sort of being a family man as opposed to doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is practicing. And it's, I mean, on the surface it seems that, well, you know, these poor women are being attacked, he should defend them. It seems like right to us, right? You know, we're householders. Of course it seems right to us. But given this Paguna's place in life, this is actually an improper thing to do. And conversely, the Bhikkhunis shouldn't be defending him either for the same reason. It's improper for them. So what the Buddha is saying is, you get sort of know where you are in life, know what your duties are in life, and stick with those. And don't get caught up in a lot of other things that are not relevant to you. Particularly if you've gone forth. Well, I don't think anybody here has gone forth. But it has that flavor of understanding where you are in life and acting according to where you are in life. There's that sense of it. On a deeper level, basically what the Buddha is saying is, do your duty. And your duty, both for Paguna and for the Bhikkhunis, is to practice. That was their duty. I mean, if you're a monk or a nun, your duty is to practice. End of list of things your duty have. You know, other than, you know, you're supposed to, you know, take care of people if they're sick and things like that, but that's considered practice. And by acting as he's doing, he is essentially generating in him, both him in for himself and for the Bhikkhunis, a very distinct sense of self. Of, I'm the guy who takes care of the Bhikkhunis. And the Bhikkhunis are, we're the Bhikkhunis who get taken care of by this guy, Paguna. He's generating a lot of self energy as opposed to selflessness. Not self, which is one of the three pillars of the practice. The way he's acting is taking him away from the practice as opposed to towards the practice. And that's really what the Buddha is concerned with here. He's concerned with the fact that he's built this identity as the guy who takes care of the Bhikkhunis. And we all do that all the time. We build all kinds of identities about, I'm the person who does X. And so we have to watch that. You know, in the broader sense of our lives in the world, it's not that we don't have duties. You know, we're all householders. We have duties as householders, you know, that we have to fulfill. But we have to watch that we don't take on, we think, oh, we're supposed to solve all the problems in the world. And it's not that we shouldn't pay attention to how things aren't going right and how sometimes we have to step up. I mean, look at that. A case in Portland just a week or so ago where those men stepped up and did what they should have done, unfortunately for them. But yeah, sometimes you have to do that too. It's not that you can just let people act out inappropriately, but you have to do it within the context of who you are and what your life is about. There's another thing the Buddha is talking about, and that's the fact that these people, both Paguna and the Bhikkhunis, got angry. In another place, the Buddha says, all anger, doesn't say some anger, he says all anger, arises from thwarted lust or wounded pride. Either I didn't get something I wanted, or someone treated me or spoke of me in a certain way that I didn't like. That's the source of all anger. These are both strong ways of identifying as a separate self. So when you see anger arise, you go, oh, that could be a problem. So Joseph Goldstein has to say about this particular topic. talking about anger here. When we become angry, for example, first there is some external situation prompting the anger to arise. Someone is doing or saying something we do not like, or we feel is harmful to ourselves or others. Second, there is our reaction to that situation, namely the feeling of anger. And the third component is the relationship of our mind to the anger itself. Usually we are lost in the first two, the external situation and our reaction to it. Something happens, we get angry. As we get angry, we start thinking about what happened. All those thoughts create more anger, which in turn creates more thoughts about the situation, often with blame, self-righteousness, and hurt feelings. Sound familiar? It's like that, the mind, when you get angry, your mind's like whirling, literally whirling. Thus, we quickly become caught in a destructive loop. If you seek a way out of such cycles, try turning your attention away from the situation and your reaction to it and toward the third component. This is that way to abandon. The relationship of your mind to the emotion, whether it is anger, fear, or whatever. For example, in the midst of the whirlwind of anger, you might ask yourself, how am I getting caught in this anger? How am I getting hooked by it? How am I identifying with it? Asking some form of that question is completely different from considering the external situation. So the story we keep telling ourselves goes away. At such a time, we are no longer sending out threads of blame that bind us to the situation, to the reaction, and to our identification with the emotion. We are no longer thinking about the external causes of the anger, so we are no longer feeding it. We also do not ask the question for the purpose of getting an answer. That's an interesting thought. We ask the question not expecting an answer or having an intellectual response. Rather, the question's purpose is to help us change perspective, to take responsibility for what arises in our mind. In the moment of asking, how am I getting hooked? We've already moved outside the anger and are looking at the way we are relating to it. It is possible in that moment for the whole mass of anger to dissolve without denying it, repressing it, or shoving it away, which are just ways of causing more trouble. Right? It's just, so what he's saying is, here's how you abandon. Step back and say, you can. Some, I have a favorite question. I can say, what's going on? What's going on? Because you can see chaos is reigning, and you go, what's going on? It's my version of these questions. And it's just that it gives you that little bit of space that often for me also, I try and really pay a lot of attention to what's going on in my body at that moment. Because the body is often a very clear mirror of the mental state. And if I can just drop out of paying attention to the story, ask the question, and then just drop right into my body and feel the unpleasantness, usually, of what's going on. It helps me tune in to something totally different than the story. It lets me step back from the reaction, the mental process. And as he says, sometimes... It's possible, no, it says it is possible. It's not saying it's going to. It is possible in that moment for the whole mass of anger to dissolve. You set up the causes and conditions for something to change. This is a right effort explained in a particular way. I want to point out one other thing. This is not something, this idea of, because what he's talking about here is people insult us. You know, people say things to us. People act in certain ways that seem rude or whatever. And we get upset. that's just a big waste of energy. The upset part. You know, someone cuts us off on the freeway, and we get into this long rant about how rude this person is and blah, 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 blah. Instead of, have a nice day. But this, and this, and one other thing I want to point out is, this is not something that's unique to the Buddha. All religious traditions have some idea of this sort of same way of being. I used to, for many years, be part of the Shivananda Yoga Vedanta organization. And Swami Shivananda of Rishikesh had this famous saying that was written on all ashram walls everywhere he went. Bear insult, bear injury, highest yoga. Exactly the same thing the Buddha is talking about. And the other danger we have to watch for here is, you know, in Paguna's case, he probably felt quite right to protect the Bhikkhunis. It was like, I'm doing the right thing taking care of these poor women. And this, that sense of righteousness, of righteous anger. Yeah. And it's not that we shouldn't act, as I said, but if we act from a place of anger, it's like throwing fuel on the fire. It's just going to cause, you know, more trouble. I mean, you see that all the time. I was involved in the demonstration world during the Vietnam War and those times. And there was so much anger. Of course nothing ever worked out. Because people were so angry all the time, on both sides, that it just got things going and more anger arose. And you see that today all the time in the political world that we're watching unfold before us every day. It's just so full of anger on both sides that, of course, nothing's going to work out of this. It's got to be come from a different angle somehow. Without the righteous anger, I'm right that Donald Trump is a blankety blankety blank, whatever my version of that is today, and I'm so angry about it, and then I'm going to act out of the anger. Nothing good ever is going to come from that. Nothing will ever come of that. It's that finding that place where we know what we have a correct understanding, but we don't act from a place of anger. So that we don't have that righteousness involved. There's another, then this the sutta goes on. There's another story here, another example that, once again, everyone will understand from Buddha's time. Suppose there was a big solid tree grove near a village or town, and it was choked with castor oil weeds, and some man would appear desiring his good welfare and protection. He would cut down and throw out the crooked saplings that rob the sap. He would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight, well-formed saplings, so that the salad tree grove later on would come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. We all garden, right? This is Boulder. Everybody has a lot of people garden. But you know, you pull out the weeds, you thin the plants, otherwise nothing grows right. So too, bhikkhus, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to the wholesome states. Keep the strong, healthy plants and get rid of the weeds. For that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Then there's another story that in this sutta that the Buddha tells. And it's, once again, a story everybody would understand, very common. And it's about this mistress Vedika and her maid Kali. And Mr. Svetika is known as a very sweet and kind and pure person. And Kali sort of has the idea, I don't think so. And so she sets out to sort of test to see how kind her mistress is. So she just gets up a little bit late one day, shows up a little bit later than she should. And mistress sort of, you know, Kali, you should be here on time. But no, not, just make a big deal out of it. So the next day, Kali gets up even later. And now the mistress starts to sort of scold her a little bit. But, you know, could explain it's her duty to come on time and da-da-da. But there's a sort of a little harshness in her voice, perhaps. Kali goes, no, no, no. So now she gets up even later. Shows up. The mistress, Vedika, gets really angry, takes a rolling pin, and whacks her across the head. And then Kali runs out into the street and says, see, you all think that Mrs. Vedika is so nice and sweet, but look what she did. She broke over my head and there's blood rushing down. So that's the story. What's the Buddha getting at here? What's behind this story? The first is that we have to be careful in this practice that we don't become pseudo practitioners. You know, that calm, I'm so holy, I'm a Dhamma teacher, oh, I must be really holy. Exterior. You know, you can't put it on. Because when you put it on, something at some point, something's going to happen where your facade of sweet and calm gets just, you're going to meet a maid called Kali and she's going to just smash it for you. Just like that. And so, it's not that you can't act that way. But it's not, it can't be an act. It has to be natural. You have to naturally be calm and kind and generous. Not act that way. Not pretend. Not put on a show. Not see I'm this holy person who practices meditation and so that I'm better than all those other people. Because we're all human beings. And that's what he's getting at here, that you have to be very careful not to get caught up in that way of thinking, that somehow I'm special, or we, us meditators, this Sangha, us Theravadins, we're really special. Boy. We got it figured out, right? Yep. You know, it's just going to get you into all kinds of trouble because you're going to be tested. And we'll talk a little bit more of that in a minute. And the other thing is, if you're putting on that act, if you're trying to look like you're never, ever anything but calm and sweet, you're probably actually just suppressing / repressing things. And the eruption's going to come, and it's going to be ugly, basically. I've seen that happen with people who have had that exterior facade and then it got cracked somehow. And it's always unpleasant to watch and be around and to experience, I'm sure. It's just something that the Buddha is saying, no, 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 don't go there either. Don't pretend. You have to sincerely abandon. You can't pretend to abandon. You can't have the show of the one who abandons things. You actually have to do something consciously. Then in the next verse, course, I just lost my page. Oh, here we go. Then in the next verse, this is probably the Buddha's most famous little part of a discourse where he's talking about speech. Because speech is often where these afflictive emotions are revealed. You know, we lash out. Bhikkhus, there are these five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or connected with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh. When others address you, their speech may be connected with good or with harm. When others address you, their speech may be spoken with a kind mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our mind will remain unaffected and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with the mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with the mind imbued with loving kindness. Starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with the mind imbued with loving kindness. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. So first of all, it's a really interesting list. You know, often you'll see this as a meme on Facebook or some such place, or Instagram or some place. You know, Buddha said speech should be, but they only list the good side. It's often listed that speech should be timely. In other words, you should be appropriate. You know, someone's really upset, and then you're going to tell them, "Oh, by the way, I'm moving." Or you got to pick your moment so that it isn't going to cause more trouble, or cause trouble. Period. For that, should be true. Should speak the truth. Should be gentle. Harsh speech. Buddha talks a lot in other places about the problems with harsh speech. Yeah. Yelling at someone never makes them feel good. I mean, there are times when you have to speak harshly. If you have a small child that won't put their hand on the hot stove, you yell. Harsh speech is very appropriate in that moment. But pretty much that's about it as far as I can see in terms of a list. You know, maybe someone's about to walk in front of a bus, you yell at them too. But I mean, you know what I mean? It's like in an emergency situation, sometimes you have to speak big. But other than that, gentle speech. Connected with good, which means useful. And spoken with a mind of loving kindness. Think about most of the speech we see in the world reported in the news, for instance. It's probably at least 3 out of 5 of these aren't there. And sometimes all 5 aren't there. This is a real practice, you know. To actually pause before you say something, especially if it's something that you think is kind of momentous or important, and go, does it fit this list? So that's one thing the Buddha's getting at here. But he lists both sides. So it should, should be timely. Or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with the mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. And then he says, no matter what, whether it's either of those, the mind remains unaffected. It's interesting, huh? And this is the part that those Facebook memes miss completely, of course. It's like you have to be careful because you start of if people are always kind and saying sweet and nice things to you, then the mind gets affected and, I'm so great. I'm so wonderful. Look at all these wonderful things people say to me all the time. I must be really wonderful. And we get caught in that energy of conceit. So the mind stays unaffected no matter whether it's from one side or from the other of that dichotomy of speech. That's what the Buddha means when he says the mind stays unaffected. We're not caught in either side of that story. Then the Buddha goes on and he gives these three really interesting images, I suppose is the best way, that sort of illustrate what he's talking about to a certain extent. Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, I shall make this great earth to be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man make this great earth be without earth? Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine and said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space? Bhikkhus, suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could the man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with that blazing grass torch? So all these sound pretty absurdist examples, right? But there's an interesting thing here. These similes show how we should train when affected by disagreeable speech. This is from Sherida Rogel's commentary on this, on the Majjhima Nikaya. We should be like the earth, without hostility and ill will, even when someone tries to destroy it. I mean, the earth, you know, you hack away at the earth, do all the things, lots of people are destroying the earth. The earth doesn't react. The earth doesn't care. It's unaffected. Be like empty space. You know, people trying to draw an empty space, but empty space is formless. It's indivisible. Nothing can affect it. Be like the river Ganges. Deep and immense. You know, unable to be set on fire. You can't melt away a river with a torch. So the examples he's using are sort of examples of how we might aspire to be strong and steady like the earth, to be open and free like space, to be deep and flowing constantly without change like a great river like the Ganges. Those are examples of being unaffected. Then the Buddha says something else really interesting. This is from the Dhammapada. It's again talking about this idea of being unaffected and why we probably should be unaffected. So the Dhammapada is a collection of poetic sayings of the Buddha, I suppose you could call it. This has come down from old Atula, and not just from today. They find fault with one who sits silent. They find fault with one who speaks a great deal. They find fault with one who measures his words. There's no one unfaulted in the world. There never was, will be, nor present is found anyone entirely faulted or entirely praised. Doesn't matter what you do. People are going to insult you. People are going to praise you. It's inevitable. It's this part of being a human being. There's no one who isn't at some point or other faulted or blamed and then praised. Sometimes for the same thing by different people, of course. Quite often, as a matter of fact. But it's such wisdom, huh? It's like this is going to happen. It goes on all the time, always has been, always will be. It's part of being a human being in the world. So, why be affected by something that's inevitable? Is what the Buddha is saying here. Why let that get you? Because we know it's going to happen, and it's going to happen again, and again. It's not going to happen just to you. You're not special. It happens to everybody. There is no man. There's no one unfaulted in the world. Finally, we come to the simile of the saw, which is what this whole thing was called, right? And this is the last verse. We get to the simile of the saw. It's an interesting name for the whole thing. But bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teachings. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our mind will remain unaffected, etc. The same. So he's saying, this applies to monks, to those who have gone forth. Okay, but it's an interesting example, because it seems so extreme. He's saying, even if someone comes and starts to like kill you, essentially, chop you into pieces with a two-handed saw, you're still going to have a mind of loving kindness towards those people. Now, as householders, we would probably want to defend ourselves, but as a monk, it'd actually be improper to defend yourself and act out of hatred. Interesting, huh? It would be improper to act out of hatred and try and injure them in return if you are a monk. It seems like, oh my God, how could that be? How could anybody even be like that? But there's a great story the Dalai Lama tells. This is about a monk who didn't get away in 59 when the Dalai Lama fled. He was but the Dalai Lama knew him. He got captured by the Chinese. And he was kept in prison and tortured for 20 years. Starved, tortured, beaten. Finally, after 20 years, somehow he gets out. I don't know whether he escaped or they let him go. I don't know that part of the story. It's not relevant. And he makes his way to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama is. And the Dalai Lama's, oh, his old buddy's here. Like, he was really happy to see him. And he's talking to the Dalai Lama's talking to this monk afterwards, what it was like. And the monk says, you know, I was really afraid sometimes. And the Dalai Lama says, well, of course, you know, these people are beating you and torturing you, and you can see what's happening to all these other people. The monk says, no, no, no. It wasn't that. I was afraid I might get angry at them. That's unaffected. It's possible. It's like this man had been tortured for 20 years, and his big fear was that he would get angry at the people doing it. I mean, it boggles my mind to even think about it. But that's the end point of this practice. Now, having said that, it's really important that we don't all think, oh, I can't be perfect like that, so why bother? You know, it's good to aspire to have that image in the mind, but to remember that this is a practice and we're just going on day by day, little bit by little bit, gradually, changing our reactive patterns of mind in small ways, over time, with practice. That's why they call it practice. I keep coming back to this, but it's really important. This is a practice. Practice means I try something and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I have to do it again and again and again. Get up every morning and go sit. Go on retreat. Practice. That's what this is about. There's a poem I want to read to finish up. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called Awakening Now, which speaks to exactly what I was talking about. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid, and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and the refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. I'll read that line again. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening. Poetry always says it way better than I can.